I want to welcome you to the fifth seminar in a series of nine offered by the Jung Center of Western Mass. And as you already know, this seminar tonight, our speaker is Erica Lorenz, and our topic is active imagination. Assessing our creative imagination. But before we do that, I just want to go over this table. Here is the donation basket.
Louder.
Here is the donation basket.
And over there.
And over
two,
there.
Two, you can't get out the door.
And all the work of the Jung Institute is supported just by your donations and by volunteers and passion and love. So, again, the suggested donation is $10. Whatever is right for you, of course, we welcome. And that includes, as I said last time, if you want to put $100 in, that's fine too, because we're a community. And if you put $100 in, that balances out someone who's working just as hard, but maybe an artist or a teacher or who knows, who can only afford $1. So as a community, that's how we balance things
She's
out.
She's good.
So this is our basket. This is our email list, and we welcome you to put your email on there so we can get announcements. Some brochures about the nine seminars. And again, there'll be four after this one if you'd like. Erica has given you an extensive bibliography on active imagination. Please take a copy.
That's on the shadow.
This is a printout on the shadow. You're welcome to. Two books that I particularly adore, Memories, Dreams, Reflections, the memoir that Jung wrote himself, his own words. That's what you want to read before you read what people say about him. Beautiful book, Courage, Determination of a Man to Go into the Unconscious at a time when that certainly wasn't popular and still isn't necessarily popular. And also, here's a book Joan Chatterow did, Jung on Active Imagination. You can support your local bookstores, but you can also get these on Amazon. I got these each for $3, used in excellent condition. We're starting something new, or we started it last week, because people have so much experience and so much to say, and because you, the audience, really, as you know, when you think about your own life, have so many experiences that you might talk about, so much you might share in conversation with our speakers, in this case, Erica, and so much to inspire each other. And I know a good many of you, and I know how active imagination is already in your life. So after the seminar, which is a limited time, we're inviting you to sit with Erica at my house. We have nice fire and cider, but most of all, we'll have some of you come in like a salon. It will be informal, and we will say what we want to say and ask what we want to ask and see what happens.
And the red book, you see two copies will be there, so you can look through the beautiful paintings that Jung did.
So these are directions. Erica said I didn't put strongly enough that they're directions.
Well, when is that going to
be? Right after.
Right after this, my house is five blocks off Main Street. There are directions here.
Off South Street.
From Main Street. Kind of. So I think if you read the directions, you won't have any trouble. But you know the Academy of Music? Well, that's Route 10, that's Old South Street. You go down there through the stoplights. The fifth block on the left is Fort Street, F-O-R-T. You take a left on the Fort. Go a few yards and take a right onto Manham. And my house is number 40. You can walk it, but it's raining and dark. Driving it is simple. And again, the directions here are pretty simple. And we'd love to have you. I think after these talks, I often have stirred up and then I have no one to talk to. So we're trying to create and continue conversation in an informal way, fun, so humor. Okay. Did you say that? Oh, I'm sorry. And the bathroom is right outside this door. Once Erica starts talking, we don't have an intermission. You're on your own. Okay. Anything else? Okay. So, Erica, I'll fit them in. Erica, should I use that, or can everyone hear me?
No.
Hear you. Okay. Erica is a Jungian analyst in private practice here in Northampton and also in Brattleboro, Vermont. She is on the training board of the Jung Institute of Boston, where she is a training analyst. She is also president of the Western Mass Jung Center. She is very experienced, many years of experience in living and in working as a therapist. And she has taught throughout the United States and Canada. And I thought it might be interesting for you to hear some of the intriguing subjects that she has taught. Spirituality and the body. Jung's collective works, including visions of Nietzsche's Zarathustra seminars. Redemption of the feminine erotic soul. Alchemical symbolism. The body as shadow. Nonverbal communication and the interactive space in analysis. So I just wanted to say that to give you some idea of the range of things that she is interested in and she is talking about. She also asked me to announce that on Friday, January 18th,
next week,
that's next week, at St. James Episcopal Church in West Hartford, Connecticut. She will be talking on Jung, spirituality, and the body. And that will happen at 7:30. And what is this website? Or the
Connecticut Association for Jungian Psychology is on their website.
Okay. And she's also going to be doing that talk a little later in the spring, probably in February.
The end of June.
Oh, June?
Yeah.
All the way into June. At the end of June, with some experiential listening.
The somatic unconscious.
To the somatic unconscious. Also, she wants, we should know that we are now on NEP? New England Public Radio website.
Okay. This talk.
And this talk will be on the New England Public Radio website. I think that's it. By the way, I called Erica to ask her how she was doing, and I found her sitting on the floor surrounded by piles of material. And she said, "Whoa, what's the matter?" Well, she said, the problem is I could talk for 4 hours, but I have to cut it down to an hour. So that was the struggle, and that's why we meet afterwards and talk some more if we want. You know, I wonder if you sometimes ask yourself, why are you here? Now, of course, that could mean, why are you here on Earth? And also, why are you here at the Jung seminars, compared to any other place you might be? So I kind of asked myself that, you know, what draws me to Jung and to people like Erica Lorenz, who study and teach Jung? And the answer that came to me was, okay, I'm 69 years old, 69 years of living, 40 years of being a clinical psychologist. Hey, something wonderful is happening. I'm dying and birthing at the same time. My body seems to be sinking into the earth on its journey to becoming humus. But my spiritual life seems to be insisting on taking up more space and more time. Recently, I had a vision. I was standing on the edge of a cliff. It was the edge of the earth, and in front of me was the galaxy, an infinite unknown. And it was my developmental task at this age to jump. I can tell you, I was standing there, scared. Finally, I jumped, and a great widening occurred in my psyche, a great deepening. My eyes opened in a different way. Doors opened. Understandings came. Hey, I want conversation about this journey. I want conversation about what I've discovered in healing myself, and I want to speak with others about what it means to be fully human, all about what is the real range of being a human being, not what I get limited to very often. I won't say what limits me. Okay, and of course Jung was the leader. Jung was a person who's a great soul, a great person, who could talk, who could jump into these vast vistas, which many of us are afraid to go into, and yet they influence our lives so deeply. So, that was my answer why I'm here, and because other people, Jung and the people who follow him, have that kind of spirit. And I know many of you in the audience, and I know many of you have that too. And that's why I, at my age, after all I've studied, when I started out as a chemist, I've turned to Jung's writing, and to these seminars, and to these people who speak here. So, this brings me back to Erica. In addition to being a Jungian analyst, Erica was first a dance therapist, and later she studied authentic movement with Janet Adler for many years. I know her in my role as board member, as friends, and as companion to explore this magnificent journey into the unconscious. Erica and Linda in the front row and I meet and we dive. We use the active imagination to explore the depths, and then we come back and share that with each other. That's some of the kind of friends I like to have at this time. That's how I like to spend my time. I encourage you to take a look at Erica's website. Her images that she has chosen speak volumes. She's comfortable with the dark as well as the light, with above as well as below, of diving into the unconscious waters and returning to the shore. I'm greatly looking forward to hearing what she has to say tonight, and I hope those of you that it's right for will join us afterwards for cider and conversation. Thank you. Erica.
That was glowing. Thank you.
Is this on enough? Okay. Welcome. Oh, I don't know how to put it off. Technical stuff. I'll just try to speak. Is that better? Okay. I don't know. Is it? I'll try to speak up. How's that? Okay. Welcome. My journey began, of course, like all of our journeys in my childhood, but in 1975, some of you in Northampton know Janet Adler with Authentic Movement. 1975, I started doing active imagination through movement with Janet Adler. And when I had studied much dance, but when I got on the authentic movement floor, which we'll talk about a little bit, where I didn't have to do anything but listen to my somatic unconscious and follow it, I felt like I had found my home. And that led me more into Jung. So, and I will be giving some case examples tonight of people who are doing various kinds of active imagination in my practice, and I have permission from all of them, and they're quite the gift to be given somebody's experience so I can share it with you. Thank them. Okay, Jung said, and so it is with the hand that guides the crayon or the brush, the foot that executes the dance step, with the eye and the ear, with the word and the thought, a dark impulse is the ultimate arbiter of the pattern. A dark impulse meaning our unconscious, something that is unconscious to us. An unconscious a priori precipitates itself into plastic form. Over the whole procedure, there seems to reign a dim foreknowledge, not only of the pattern, but of its meaning. Image and meaning are identical. Isn't that wonderful? Image and meaning are identical. As the first takes shape, the image, so the latter becomes clear. So, and during this time, I'm not up here to just talk at you. So if you have questions and thoughts as we go along, I'd rather have a Socratic dialogue here. Okay, so if you don't understand what I'm saying or whatever, or if you have a question or a thought. Okay. All right. So so that is Jung talking about active imagination, which he developed in about 1910 when he began his own descent into the unconscious, which the Red Book is his chronicle of that, which was just published in 2009. It's beautifully done, and he also painted, paintings are gorgeous. So we'll have that, you can look at it a little after, and then we'll have it over at Carol's house. Okay, so Jung felt that the crisis, I put this over here so I can read it. The crisis of our age is alienation and splitting. As a Jungian analyst who has had a lot of training in the body, it's interesting because Anita Green, who is also an analyst here in this area, she said to me once, she said, you know, I found myself going to my analyst and then going to my body worker and then going to my analyst and my body worker and then I decided I needed to put it together. So I have done a lot of work on putting it together. And so when I'm working with somebody, I'm constantly, even if they don't have to move or anything, but I'm just constantly aware of the somatic unconscious and the nonverbal communication. And I think this is so hard for our modern age, are we really experiencing what we're talking about? We can talk about dreams and analyze them up here for years and not transform. And that's what Jung says over and over and over in his writing, that if it's not an experience, no transformation takes place. And that's what active imagination is about. So the crisis of our age, and he said anybody over the age of 35, their crisis is really a spiritual crisis. I don't know why I chose 35, but it seems a little young to me, but... and the whole object is to find our true nature, to put our body, instinct, soul together so we can not only relate to ourselves fully and in an, as what Jung would say, individuated way, which does not mean individualistic, does not mean perfect. It means being who we truly are in all of our manifestations. And if we have that, then we can relate, we can feel into the source, the ecosystem, the interconnectedness of what we're doing here on the planet, which is very important. Okay, so Jung says, the body is merely the visibility of the soul, the psyche. And the soul is the psychological experience of the body. So really, it is really one and the same thing. Okay. So let me put a little context here, and I have some wonderful movie clips and some case material that will help it get us really clear. So in our first half of life, we have a very specific task, but I also want to say that children do active imagination automatically. Anybody who has had children know this. They have imaginary friends, they have transitional objects, I love working with children. I did it a little, that's what I was trained in originally, because to just give them the space and the tools to work with, and they will just automatically start working with their psychological wherever they are, through art, through play therapy, through movement. And my first work was done with autistic and schizophrenic children and adolescents, so the verbal was not helpful, but I did movement with them. I allowed them to express themselves through movement, and that's how we could communicate. So the first half of life is very important. It's the creation of the subject, of me, as distinct from other people, mom, dad, whatever. It's hopefully the development of a healthy ego, and it's the development of consciousness out of the unconscious. And it's a very important time of learning to adapt, to set boundaries, to discriminate. And in our culture, of course, we really emphasize the left brain, right? And the right brain, unless you're in a creative environment, is pretty much left out, which is basically what Jung was saying, that we need to balance, we need to have the balance, or we're not whole. So the left brain is emphasized, and whatever is not developed in ourselves, and that means wonderful gifts, as well as this painful things that we repress, we project it onto the world, onto other people. And this causes splits within ourselves, so that if you begin to become aware, of course you know there's the judge. We all know about the judge, right? That's a part of our psyche. There are many different parts of our psyche that get split up. So what we're trying to do with active imagination is have a conscious dialogue with unconscious parts or split off parts of ourselves, and also with the divine, our divine nature. Okay, and we develop defenses. I like to call defenses protection. That's why we develop them, to protect ourselves. We develop splits through the body, mind, the inner, outer, the soul, spirit, matter, and our personal unconscious, that what develops in our childhood becomes our personal myth. And that's then what Jung said. He said, when he left Freud, he said, what is my personal myth? I have to find my personal myth. And that's when he chose consciously to enter into the unconscious. Jung says, no one who strives for selfhood or individuation is spared this painful process, for that which is feared also belongs to the wholeness of the self. The collective unconscious from which the ego originally emancipated itself. This liberation is certainly a very necessary and heroic undertaking, and that's where a lot of myths of the hero come in. But it represents nothing final. It is merely the creation of the subject, who, in order to find fulfillment, has still to be confronted by an object in the world that we project things onto, an object in relationship, an object in our spiritual path, whatever level it is. Okay. So we get to the second, actually I'm going to show this clip first. Because it's about a little girl. I love movies. I'm just fascinated about how people take somebody's whole life, or people take a myth, or people take something like, well, thousands of them, and try to depict in 2 hours something quite phenomenal, or mythic, or whatever. So I love showing movie clips. So this is, how many people have seen Beasts of the Southern Wild? You know, it's up for an Academy Award. And you know, the 6-year-old actress is up for Best Actress. Just amazing. So this is the story of, the reason I want to show this now is it's about a child having an active imagination in order to find herself in her own life as a being that has power and can grow up. Okay. So for those of you who haven't seen the movie, this is a very poor culture, made-up culture, that's a little island called the Bathtub that's been separated from the mainland by this huge dike. So they're just this total little community of very intensely high-spirited, alcoholic, proud people who will not leave their home. And the star is, what's her name? What do they call her?
Hush Puppy.
Thank you. Hush Puppy. Hush Puppy is a little girl whose father is alcoholic and whose father is dying, but she doesn't know this for a long time. And in this movie, the theme that she's continuously told is you have to learn how to survive. You have to be strong. You have to learn how to survive. Don't cry. You have to learn how to survive. And there's a wonderful woman who's the midwife and the teacher in the town who starts talking about animals are just, we're all just animals. We're all animals. And she talks about the myth of the aurochs, which is this ancient prehistoric beast that she has tattooed on her hip. And so she tells this story about the aurochs, that it disappeared and how do we survive. So from that, the little girl starts to imagine the aurochs slowly melting out of the ice. And it becomes a whole myth for her. Okay, and she says after this teacher talks, she says, strong animals got no mercy. They're the type of animals that eat their mommies and daddies. So this is part of her myth. And so it goes on. Ah! Is that a bad sign? Ah! Don't do that. Don't do that. Stop, 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 stop. Sorry. Sorry. Stop it. How are you doing? Sorry, we're going ahead.
Yeah, space bar, that's good. Yeah. Thank
you. Okay. Somebody always knows how to do this. Okay. Okay. So later, the father is dying, and he's in the hospital, and he tries to escape, of course, as he always does. And she's trying to help him, and he says to her, I can't take care of yourself. I'm dying. I don't want you to watch this. He's in the hospital. He's trying to get her to go home. And there's this real confrontation, and they both go home. Then there's a scene which is very important about the feminine. She and her, some school friends, end up on this boat, and they end up in a brothel, sort of. It's where people dance, and it's a brothel. And she meets the cook, who's a wonderful woman. Have you seen the movie? You're smiling because you, yeah, it's a beautiful scene. And the cook talks about how she's got to be tough, and that, and on the boat, the little girl says to the captain, which way are we going? And the captain says, it don't matter. This boat will take you exactly where you need to be. And he eats these chicken things, and there are all these wrappers that are exactly the same. piled on the floor. And he says, and she says, well, what's that for? And he says, I like the smell of them. Makes me feel cohesive. And she says, I want to be cohesive. And he says, I'm sure you will be, baby. There's no doubt in my mind. I have to put on a southern accent. I forget what a southern accent is. And then, so the cook, this wonderful woman who starts to nurture her, and she's cooking, and she says, one day it's going to be all on you. So smile, girl. Nobody likes a pity potty. The gate is magic. And the little girl, and the woman picks her up, and they're dancing. And the little girl says to herself, I can count all the times I've been lifted on two fingers. So this is the kind of survival that this little girl goes through. And then she says, I got to go back and take care of my daddy. So that's where we're going to start the film. Okay? So she's going back. I keep doing it twice. It's coming. They're the aurochs.
I gotta take care of mine. Thank you.
Real good.
Quiet behind my eyes. I see everything that made me flying around in invisible pieces. When I look too hard, it goes away. But when it all goes quiet, I see they're right here. I see that I'm a little piece of a big, big universe. And that makes things right. Scientists of the future, they're gonna find it all. They're gonna know.
Powerful. I love power. So let's use our imagination a little bit, and I want you to just sort of not analyze this. We don't need to analyze it. The image is the meaning. So as you see her go through her process, what comes up for you about what's going on, or what happens inside you as you watch this?
I can just imagine the director. There's something awfully sad to think of, so she can cry as she's about to
What? Say it again? Can you speak up?
I can imagine the director giving her something sad to think about so that she can cry. It's hard to cry that much when you're just acting. I can only imagine what the director holds her in the face of. But she was a good actress.
For me, the most powerful part was when she stopped and turned around and faced the imaginary downstairs, and that just was so powerful to me, because I think that's probably something that everybody can relate to, as a child especially, like, imagining you're being pursued by something, and like, having the courage to turn around and face it. It was just, like, my heart was just just like grace that you can handle that.
Yeah, yeah. How do we turn around and face whatever?
Yeah.
What we're afraid of, what's unconscious. That's what we're trying to do, isn't it?
Yeah, and that they all go out to her. That was just so cool.
Yeah. Did everybody hear? Mm-hmm. Basically? Okay.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead. I thought it was interesting that they showed that scene where she faced the imaginary beasts and the courage that that took, where all her friends ran away, afraid, and then the courage that it took for her to face her dying father.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was an interesting kind of progression there.
Yeah. So what's your fantasy? Well, this is analyzing, isn't it? What transformation is happening for this little girl? What transformation would be happening in you?
Well, it's power in her vulnerability. It's very powerful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, she gets the strength to go on past her father. You know, she realizes she's strong enough.
Uh-huh. Yeah, she's strong enough to face. Yeah, to take care of my own. I have to take care of my own, she says to them. Yeah, go ahead.
I find it very interesting, you know, her tears, and then later on, how straight she was sitting and standing, and the more she was going into visualizing herself that she's just one piece, she stood so regal and so proud. You could see the strength in her, and I thought that was very powerful. And I thought, wow, you know, that's that inner self. She was in tune and really standing her ground of who she was.
So facing the beast helps her to find herself. Facing.
Well, there was the beast, the death of her father.
Yeah.
Walking through her friends or the people that she knew, and then facing the death of her father, mm-hmm. putting him in his burial because she's the one that lighted the,
mm-hmm.
the torch.
Mm-hmm.
And then go away.
Yeah.
And then standing by herself there.
Mm-hmm.
And standing so strong and upright.
So this is a little girl, you know. So she's found herself in a way, in a very powerful way, right? Where she can now take care of her own. You know?
Right.
Yeah. Okay, yeah.
I've got a sense in the final scenes where she's watching her father's cremation, the sense of her understanding the disintegration and connection cosmically, I guess, mm-hmm. to the greater world,
mm-hmm.
her own place in it.
Yeah. So how did that feel? Movie scenes, of course, are so, they draw us in and they're so powerful. So does anybody have a feeling that came up as you were watching it? Well, you said one. Yeah. I'm when I see that movie, it's almost like my breath stops. It's like, whew.
I felt fear, the fear of facing the father,
fear his death.
Also the community that she's, that of the fear of being oneself in community and not having to be totally a part of it, to stand on it on one's own.
Yeah, and the last scene, they're walking along this big dike, this big thing, and she's in front. She has become a community leader.
Yeah.
Gretchen.
I thought it was, for me, her capacity to embrace the imaginal was equal to her capacity to open up to the real.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And so I didn't see her as fearful. I saw her as just being very much in the real because she had the capacity for the imaginal.
Mm-hmm. And that's what we're after, isn't it? When we have the capacity to face whatever the imaginal is, the imaginal realm, the Sufis called it the mundus imaginalis, then then something shifts in us, and we can be more real in this world. That's the whole point, isn't it? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Good. Okay. One more, and then we'll go.
Just the imagery, like first she's with the friends, and then the friends leave. So she's with a group, she's alone, and then the creatures come. And then she's with them. Mm-hmm. And then they go away, she's alone. She walks to her people. Then she's with her father. And then his heart stopped beating and she's alone. And then, I mean, like when she's lighting the funeral, the briar, she's with him, and then she lets him go. I mean, it's like a constant dance of the connection and the being with herself.
And that's what we're doing, isn't it? We're constantly finding our own, and that allows us to be in the proper relationship with community, with people we love.
Because she says, "I'm a little piece of the big."
Yeah.
Like she's not separate from, even though at times she's standing by herself.
Right.
And in fact, she's saying that at the moment she's standing the most by herself, but these other connections are still there.
I'm a little piece of the universe.
Yeah.
Now that oneness. So she's got all levels. Okay, let's keep going here. We'll talk more. Okay. Okay. It is in the, Jung says, it is in the creative fantasies that we find the unifying function, meaning that we find the pieces in ourselves that come together. And that creates a new attitude in us, a new courage, a new sense of self, a new perception of the world, a new way of being, a way to move forward from something that's hung us up for our lifetime, whatever. Okay. It is the creative fantasies that we find the unifying function we seek. All the functions that are active in the psyche converge in fantasy. Fantasy has its own irreducible value, for it is a psychic function that has its roots in the conscious and the unconscious alike. So that's why we want to have a conscious dialogue with the unconscious. In the individual as much as in the collective, in me as much as in you, or the collective unconscious, which would be the divine realm of the unconscious. If it is understood hermeneutically or as a healing, it is an authentic symbol. It acts as a signpost, providing the clues we need in order to carry our lives in harmony with ourselves. And that's what she came to at that moment, right? She came to a harmony within herself of being a little girl, needing to take care of father, being a part of community, being part of herself, being a part of the universe. Imagination is a concentrated extract of the life forces, both physical and psychic. Okay. So, here we have an image of her really becoming herself, maybe fully for the first time. And so in the second half of life, we get the opportunity to have a rapprochement, to come back, because there's a period of time, little girls, Maladoma Patrice Sommet, in his book that is on your bibliography, In the Water and the Spirit, talks about in his African tribe how the children are raised by the grandparents, because the grandparents are closest and the children are the closest to the unconscious. Mm-hmm. And then at a certain point, the child has to come into the community and learn how to do whatever the community needs us to do, to participate as an adult with all the stuff we have to do in the world. And then the elder, then at a certain point we get to go more into the spiritual realm again. But these are developmental phases. And Jung was fascinated with the second half of life. He said that's where we really have the opportunity to become fully whole. So we have a chance to have a rapprochement with the shadow and with the self, the big S self, as Jung would say, which would be the source, God, oneness, whatever it is that we want to say about that. And it's interesting because I don't know a lot about brain research, but something I just learned about is as we get older, a certain age, the corpus callosum that connects the right and the left brain becomes thicker, becomes more more alive. So we're actually wired at that point to integrate the left and the right brain. And the left brain being the thinking brain, the rational brain, the brain that helps us to analyze, the right brain being the intuitive brain, the brain that where we connect with the oneness, the brain where what?
Creativity, right.
Intuitive. Okay. So we get a chance to face each split off part of ourselves. And that can be part of the personal unconscious, which is developed in childhood, or part of our spiritual journey. And we get a chance once again to find our own truth. And as we all know, this is a lifelong process. There's a Jungian analyst, Marie-Louise von Franz, who people would come to her and they'd say, so how long does this take? And she said, the rest of your life. When you're done, you don't need to be here anymore. Okay, and also, so what we're trying to do is we're trying to unburden the poor little ego, and I see ego as a little different than from the Eastern religions, they talk about ego as a negative thing. I see ego as a function that mediates between the inner world and the outer world. So that's very important. If you don't have a healthy ego, you can't do active imagination. And as we do active imagination, the ego lets go more and more and allows the unconscious to lead, which is what we want to accomplish.
Because if the ego boundaries aren't good enough, you're going to get swamped.
Right. If you have a weak ego or an undeveloped ego, you get overwhelmed, you get too swamped, you can't stay. I had years ago, I had a client who's a wonderful poet, who said, if I can just step an inch away from whatever I'm enmeshed in, whatever complex I'm in, whatever issue I can't figure out, if I can just step an inch away from it so I can look at it, then I can do something. And that's what we're trying to do with active imagination. Okay. So we want a healthy ego. A healthy ego is a flexible ego. It can listen, it can see what we need to do out here, and it can also pay attention and allow itself to listen to our inner guide, our inner source, our inner, whatever is pursuing us. Like in this fantasy, these beasts are pursuing her. And there are many, 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 many dreams of being pursued by something. You know, I'm sure lots of people in here have had those dreams. And there's a very important point where my webmaster is telling me to do things. There's a very important point where we have to turn and face it, or it will burden us. It will be in our way the rest of our lives. Remember the film with Whoopi Goldberg, who went to a convent, and she was teaching singing.
Yeah.
What was that?
Jumpin' Jack Flash.
Sister Act. And there's this woman who has this young girl who has this beautiful voice, but her mother won't let her sing because the father was a singer and he left, so the mother won't let her sing. So the movie is about Whoopi Goldberg getting this child, this teenager, to be able to sing. And so that's another place. A lot of our gifts don't have a chance to develop. So that's another thing that we can tune into. Okay. So the whole point is, how do we heal the splits, become whole? And then Jung never was a proponent of, then you go off and you live in a cave. Then how do we bring that back to the community? So So Jung, when he started to descend into the unconscious, he closed his eyes and he allowed himself to feel. And what he felt was he felt himself dropping. That was his experience. That was his threshold. That was the door for him. We all have to find the door. Everybody has a different, like I'm very kinesthetic. So that's why active imagination through movement is where I find my deepest place. If you're an artist, you might be very visual. Jung was very visual and very auditory. He heard whole dialogues. He had dialogues in his head, in his imagination. If you think of a famous chef, you know, they're creating, they're having a whole experience around what? Taste and smell. I love that image because it's totally different from me. Something I'm not as involved with. So we each have to find our medium, and sometimes it's good to use a medium that we aren't familiar with. Like I've had people who come in who are professional dancers or professional musicians, and they get so caught up in the technique of it that it's sometimes good to do a medium that you aren't familiar with. But the point is to find the doorway in. We each have to find how we enter into the unconscious. Okay. So we need to have the symbol, and it needs to be a living symbol. If it's not a living symbol, it's just like I might walk into a church and the cross doesn't do anything for me. But for somebody else, it's very powerful. But for me, when I'm by the ocean, it's very powerful. What are some places for you that the symbol is very alive, a symbol that is alive? It speaks to you. It tries to point you in a direction. It takes you to another way of perceiving. It touches your soul. Anybody have a symbol? That's
trees.
Dreams?
Trees.
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 Trees. Trees.
Trees.
What was that?
Trees. Trees. Yeah, the sun.
Sun? Mm-hmm. Anybody else?
Desert.
Okay.
Hills.
Hills?
Fire.
Fire? Yeah. Anybody else?
Rhythm.
Okay. Anybody else?
It's funny that what you're describing, you're experiencing, is the same sort of thing that Shaman described. Like Marcella describes, Shaman described the experiencing when they're going under.
Right, absolutely.
Either going, feeling like they're falling in or feeling like they're rising.
Right. Yeah, the Shaman has to be able to go to the upper world, the underworld, and the middle world. And they have to be able to navigate that. Yeah. I mean, if you look at the basis of all different religions, they all basically are talking about the same thing. How do we enter into a relationship, a correct relationship with the unconscious, the divine, whatever that is, right? Okay, yeah.
My question, well, I've read something recently, and it was that you have to uncover the unconscious, but the superconscious has to be revealed to you. So I'm wondering how you're thinking in those terms.
Yeah.
The superconscious.
Yeah. Yeah, that what you're talking about, the superconscious versus the, what was the word you used?
You uncover the unconscious.
Unconscious.
But you have to wait for the superconscious to be revealed.
Right, so that's when I was talking about the personal unconscious, which is developed in childhood, is something that we can pretty easily access. But the superconscious, as you say, or the transcendental, is something that we are touched by grace. You can try to open to it, you can meditate, you can do various things, but it comes when it wants, right?
You can't drop into it like you can the unconscious.
Well, it is a lower part of the unconscious, or a different, the bigger part of the unconscious.
And oh, it
is. Yeah.
Superconscious is part of the unconscious.
Yeah, it's all unconscious because it's unconscious, as Jung says in the BBC interviews. It's unconscious because it's unconscious.
Like the iceberg in the water.
Or different levels of the ocean, perhaps. You can there's a place where you can swim. And there's a place where you can't just go swim. It's deep, it's dark, it's has strange creatures in it that we don't understand. Or outer space. Actually, now since we are able to explore the ocean, now outer space in our fantasies has become more the collective unconscious, is what Jung would call it. It's like the mystery, where we can't go fully unless you're a shaman or something. Okay, so there's some very important pieces to this. So we have to have the living symbol, and it has to be a felt experience. And a living symbol is very important because it's a conduit. It's a conductor. If we have a symbol, if a symbol comes up, and when I'm talking about image or symbol, again, it could be, for me, it can be very kinesthetic. I can have the places I go deepest are in my body. So I'll have a sensation that will take me there. My body will start vibrating, or I'll have a emotion. You can start with an emotion. Or I'll have my stomach will be upset. So if I begin to tune into that, then I can begin to have a dialogue with it. But the whole, and this is where it's so hard for modern, I don't like to say Western anymore because it's modern, the modern culture to understand that this is not just fantasy, it's real. We live in the imagination a lot. And if you don't think we don't, just look around. Look at politics. Who's imagining what? And where what imaginings are totally caught and totally rigid, that there is no dialogue. Okay, so we need the symbol, because the symbol is a conductor. Like for her, the aurochs helped her to focus. It brought something to her attention. It brought energy. It brought a confrontation. And it was very alive for her. It also makes the experience manageable. When we go into a sacred space, whatever that space is for us, the space, the ocean, whatever it is, creates a temenos, a sacred space where we can allow something to happen, or something may be more likely to happen. And when I'm doing active imagination, I want to set up a sacred space for myself, whatever that is. For me, it's a particular room with candles, but we all have to find our own way to create that container, because our culture doesn't have those containers, right? It's very hard to find those containers. Okay. Okay. Jung says, well, here's a quote. Okay. We may reorient toward our body, discover it has a life, and with that a new kind of being awake. Our body reactions aid this if we listen to them and use them to go deeper into the material we hear, rather than ignoring them and grasping for a theory or amplification as a life preserver. We begin to be able to sit and be dumb, to not know, to listen and respect this process. Most of all, we begin to respect silence, for we know that only if something appears will it have value. We will find nothing, certainly nothing we look for, through theory or introspection. Only a mutual discovery can be of value. So when Jung started his descent, he had some visions. Did anybody see A Dangerous Method? Only one person? They got his visions wrong. But he had visions right before this whole process started for him, about Europe being covered with this river of blood and bodies floating in the rivers of blood. And later he realized that was a portending of World War I. And then he started to do his own descent. And this is, so he says, in his 40th year, he says, I've achieved everything that I had wished for myself, honor, power, wealth, knowledge, every human happiness. Then my desire for the increase of these trappings ceased. And a lot of people in here know that moment. It's like we've done it. We're adults in the second half of our life. we've got our profession together, we have our family, all that's wonderful, but there's something more, there's something that we're missing. And so in the beginning of the Red Book, he descends and he discovers the spirit of the times, which is his outer life, all the things that he does, and the spirit of the depth that asks him to go into the unconscious, challenges him. And then, so he goes into the unconscious and he says, and he's having his active imagination, he's quiet, he's just listening, and what comes up for him is, my soul, where are you? Do you hear me? I speak, I call you, are you there? I have returned. How warm the joy of seeing you again. You long disavowed soul. Life has led me back to you. My journey should continue with you. And then in his commentary to understand this, so in active imagination there are three parts. One is to let the material come up, to get out of the way, to let the material come up. And there may be many different ways of doing that, which I'll get to. Then we after the material comes up, we sit with it, we don't analyze it, but we ponder it, we let it be alive. Did you have a word?
Observe it.
Observe it. Yeah, we observe it, we feel it, we connect to it, we sort of stay with it. And then we begin to understand it, we begin to integrate it. And then the last piece is, Jung would say, is an ethical piece, and we bring it back into our lives and the people that we are connected to. So he says, as he's thinking about it, as he's pondering this, he says, I have thought and spoke much of the soul. I had judged her and turned her into an object. The spirit of the depths forced me to speak to my soul, to call upon her as a living and self-existing being. I had to learn that I had lost my soul. To the spirit of the time, the soul is a thing. He whose desire turns away from the outer things reaches the place of the soul. If he, she does not find the soul, emptiness is there and will overcome us. A little later he says to the soul, I am weary, my soul. My wandering has lasted too long, my search for myself outside myself. Now I have gone through events and find you behind them all. His soul has been behind all of his events. You announced yourself to me in advance in dreams. I went on in the way of the day, and you went invisibly with me, putting the pieces together meaningfully, letting me see the whole in each part. You gave me where I did not expect anything, and time and again you brought about fate from a new and unexpected quarters. You upheld my belief when I was alone and near despair. At every decisive moment, you let me believe in myself. And so he's thinking, scholarliness alone is not enough. There is a knowledge of the heart that gives deeper insight. And then he says, my speech is imperfect. Out of the impossibility of finding those words, I speak in images. With nothing else can I express the words from the depth. Okay. So, there are many things that we need to face. And one of them is the shadow, which is what has developed from our personal history in our relationship to who we truly are and what we have to adapt to, right? The pieces that were left behind or are unknown. And you will recognize this, A Beautiful Mind. How many people have seen A Beautiful Mind? Okay. So we know, let's see if I can do this. So we know the story. The movie is a beautiful rendition of his intense, painful, excruciating process, as we all know. But there's a piece in the movie that really speaks to his active imagination with his shadow. So who is his shadow? Remember when he first moves into Princeton, into his dorm room? And his roommate arrives. He doesn't even know he's supposed to have a roommate. Well, guess what? He doesn't. And what are the characteristics of his roommate that are totally different from him?
He's a woman.
Literature.
I forget, but it's because he's like a womanizer.
He's a partier, womanizer.
He's literature, right?
He's a literature major as opposed to a mathematical genius. He's extroverted, right? And Nash is really introverted. He's flamboyant. He's free. He doesn't care what people think about him. Then who's the other shadow? Remember the CIA agent? And he's sort of more of a deeper shadow. So what characteristics does he have? He's very judgmental. He's kind of like the judge in a lot of ways. He makes him think he's special. You're on a mission. We need you. You have to figure this out. So he makes him feel very special in a very bad way. And there's a place in the film, remember where the little girl comes in? Mm-hmm. Remember the little girl who's the roommate's daughter? Remember her?
Yes.
She'll be here. Anyway, it's when he meets the feminine, her, the little feminine, that he begins his process of healing. So I think that's fascinating. Okay. So let me see if I can put this in and get it going here. So this is where he faces his shadow, faces these figures actively and gets a new perspective or has the courage. It has to think a little bit. Computers have to think.
Johnny, I'm sorry, but you have to tell him. Tell him you're a genius. You're a genius, Johnny!
Okay, sorry. Doesn't seem to like my bookmark. Okay.
Come. Hello, Martin. Jesus Christ. No, I don't have that one. My savior complex takes on a completely different form.
I heard what happened, and I wanted to write, and I tried Joe MacArthur's, but you left, and I just...
Genius, you're a genius, John! Tell him your work is critical, John, please!
Is there any chance that you could ignore what I just did?
Of course, what are old friends for?
Is that what we are, Martin? Friends?
John, of course. Of course, we always have been.
Alicia and I think that fitting in, being part of a community, might do me some good. And a certain level of attachment, familiar places, familiar people, might help me elbow out these certain delusions that I have. It's a lot to ask, and now that I'm here, I'm quite certain that you would just say no. But I was wondering if I could hang around. Will you be needing an office? No. Well, I could just work out of the library.
Well, this guy tries to wander into the library, but he doesn't have ID.
Why can't people read their memos, huh?
Then he goes totally nuts.
Is this what you are, soldier? Some useless tool? The local madman?
I'm not a soldier.
You're gonna end up in a cell! Old, worthless, discarded!
There's no mission.
And while you rock and drool, the world will burn to ashes!
You are not real! You are not real!
You're still talking to me, soldier!
There's no mission!
I'm not a soldier!
John? John?
John, it's okay. I just heard what happened. I'm sorry, John.
I'm not a soldier.
John, hey, Nash, hey. Hey, you all right? Nash, hey.
Ladies and gentlemen, great John, man!
John?
You should have seen their faces. Everybody's just staring at me.
John, you know that stress triggers the delusions.
No. But then on the way home, Charles was there. Sometimes I really miss talking to him. Maybe Rosen's right. Maybe I have to think about going back to the hospital again.
He's facing not just delusions and hallucinations, but he's facing parts of himself, right? His shadow, the roommate, the young feminine, which would be the young feminine in him that's very young, very immature, just beginning to develop in his psyche. And then the sort of taskmaster, judgmental person that wants him on the mission. His mission.
It's a pace bar.
Oh, it couldn't be Jack.
Space bar will stop.
It's never gonna work, John.
Help.
You're just humiliating yourself.
Space bar. Oh, space. I want it to reject.
Oh.
Oh. All right. Okay. So there's another thing I think that's very that we see that's very important in here is that he has witnesses, right? Mm-hmm. He has people who are witnessing his process. Who are they in the movie? Who are his witnesses?
His buddies.
His buddies?
When he was young.
What?
When he was young.
His you mean like the guy in the office, the
yeah.
dean? Yeah. Dean,
his wife.
Who still cares about him, and his wife, very important. She's witnessed the whole process. And who else?
The people who respect him as a professor.
People who respect him as a professor.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And yeah.
And then you have people that are curious that don't know him yet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And remember, there's that beautiful thing when the Nobel Peace Prize guy comes. And says, we want to nominate you for a Nobel Peace Prize, but we want to talk to you first. And there, he's sitting with the student, and he looks at the student and he says, is he real? And the guy says, uh-huh. But he needs these sort of people to help him to support his emerging consciousness. Yeah?
So I have a question. So what is it in him, or what part of him allows him to turn to Martin and the little girl and say, no,
mm-hmm. yeah.
you're my imagination,
right?
And I want...
You are a part of me, and I can't... But and he's beginning to integrate those a little bit.
So what is the thing in him that allows him not to be lost anymore?
Well, he's developed more of an ego, more of an observing mm-hmm. ego,
mm-hmm.
right? His before, when he starts getting into his theories and... He has this very rigid ego,
mm-hmm.
correct?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And his consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
He's been through this enough. He's been through this process of being in contact with the inner parts, so that he begins to realize that they're there, and they might have they have something to say, but he can't. He doesn't have the strength. In some ways, his strength is in his ability to know, I don't have the strength to look at, to be with you anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Which for a schizophrenic takes an, I mean, that's incredible.
Mm-hmm.
You know, takes a tremendous amount of energy and power and awareness. To go, mm-hmm. I know you are not in this outer world, you are in my inner world.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But that's developed over a long period of time, right?
Mm.
That ability.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Wouldn't true integration mean that he would be able to talk to those parts of himself
yeah.
rather than being overwhelmed by them?
Right.
Not say, I can't talk to you, rather, I
right.
will talk to you, I'll be in dialogue.
Right, yes. And that's what we could do. If you're schizophrenic, you need to separate enough
mm-hmm.
from the hallucination. And then eventually, I mean, if you think about it, at the end of the movie when he gives his Nobel Peace Prize talk, it's beautiful. He's really connected with his heart. Mm-hmm. He's not, so he develops over time. Yeah.
Would you say that the people who supported him really contributed to that?
Yes. Absolutely. In fact, in indigenous cultures, there's very little mental health like this. People do go through acute psychotic breaks, and then they are taken to the medicine shaman or the medicine person, and they stay with that person until they come through it. And then there is a ceremony that brings them back into the community, welcomes them back. So that, think of what we do. We tell people they're crazy. We put them on drugs, which may be helpful. We disenfranchise them. We isolate them. We keep them from community.
And we say that it's something intrinsic to their brain versus a process of thinking out.
What?
We say that it's something intrinsic to their brains being broken versus a process of when they can out of.
Right. Right, and if Jung differentiated, and we all differentiate between an acute psychotic break, episode of psychotic break, versus something that's organic that can't. And also, it's known in indigenous cultures when somebody has a gift of being a shaman or a medicine man or something like that, they often have a very powerful inundation of the unconscious or a psychotic episode as a part of their initiatory illness. And that's when they're recognized as being a gifted person, and they're helped. And one of the ways that one part of their training is to learn how to come through that. And that's what the wounded healer is all about. So if we're therapists, we have to go through our own process. I couldn't possibly help somebody unless I understood how to work through my own process. And by doing that, then I learn how to work with them. Jung had a very important witness, which was Tony Wolf. His wife was his anchor, but his wife hadn't descended into the unconscious. Tony Wolf had had a psychotic break, and Jung actually helped her out of it. So she understood the territory of the unconscious. She understood how to go in and out of it. She understood how to interact with it. So she was his witness, his helper through his process. So that's very important. And the witness, the word witness means to know in a deep way, one's inner knowing, native intelligence, humorous in a knowledgeable way, to look at, make pregnant. That's what being a witness means. It's good. To look at, make pregnant. So as an analyst or as a therapist, we are the witness, or as anybody in the helping professions. Okay. Jung also says, the unconscious can be reached and expressed only by symbols. And again, symbols doesn't necessarily just mean an image. It could mean a kinesthetic experience. It could mean an inner dialogue, a verbal. It could be through any of the senses. And for this reason, the process of individuation becoming whole can never do without the symbol. The symbol is the most primitive exponent of the unconscious, or I would think the instincts, perhaps. But at the same time, an idea that corresponds to the highest intuitions. So it's the lowest part of the brain, and it's the highest intuitions of the unconscious mind. So the symbol brings these two pieces together, which is why it's so powerful in our lives. This is Nathan Schwartz-Salant, an analyst. He says, so when we want to get into a state where we can do active imagination, we set up a safe space, and then we have to allow our consciousness to sort of get out of the way and lower so that the unconscious can come up. And Nathan Schwartz-Salant says, this shift of consciousness can be described as a movement from solar consciousness that readily leads to interpretations into a lunar consciousness that focuses upon the images and imaginal perceptions. This shift involves an introverted act in which psychic energy, attention and consciousness, is surrendered to the unconscious and to a symbolic sense of oneness, the one continuum, the source, whatever. So when I'm doing movement, which is my medium, my best medium. I can be in an incredibly deep, because I've been doing it for years and years and years, I can be in an incredibly deep place, either with a very intense emotion of any kind, or different energy experiences in my body, and I'm totally in it, but I know that I'm totally in it, and that's the key. So to build that awareness, it usually you need an outer witness to help you develop that. And now I don't really need an outer witness. I mean, it's helpful to have the witness. Sometimes I can go deeper just because somebody's sitting there being with me. They don't have to say anything. But I know what's happening. And as I said, and I did authentic movement groups where we would meet every week for several hours for 12 weeks or 24 weeks or whatever. And as I would witness, the person would begin to learn more and more about their own process and be able to drop in deeper and deeper and then be able to feel the container of it and be able to then learn how to work with it. Any thoughts or questions at this point?
I'm just curious how the witness does that. Why does that make a difference?
Well, that's a really good question, because it doesn't all. You don't always need a witness. I mean, sometimes what you need, like in art, is you draw something, but then you might want to take it to somebody and ponder it with somebody. So that would be the witnessing part there.
It's some way of integrating from the numinous into the world, so you're making that connection more solid no matter what you're doing.
Right.
I've been talking to someone about it, making talisman, whatever.
Right. Doing a ritual, it might lead you to doing a ritual around it. But I know it's so as somebody would be doing movement over a year, every week, certain gestures or certain things would start repeating, patterns would start repeating. And what was amazing is I didn't interpret them. The role of the witness is not to interpret or judge. The role of the witness is to say, what is this making me feel? What am I experiencing in the presence of what the unconscious is bringing up, which may or may not add something to the process. So as the pattern would continue, we would just watch it and be curious about it. Curiosity is very important here. And eventually, the person would be repeating it one day, and suddenly the mind, the body, and the soul and the gut would just get it. And it would, the image, the meaning was in the image or in the movement. And suddenly they would understand, and a whole new attitude in them or a whole new way of perceiving a particular problem that they were grappling with would just open up. So it's that aha moment, right? Where we get it. So we don't just get it up here. That's not going to just work. That'll help, maybe, but it won't ultimately work. Okay. Okay, now I'm going to show you, I mean, these the two examples I've given you have been films of these things. But now I'm going to show you a beautiful film of, did anybody come here last September and see An Appointment with the Wise Old Dog? Has anybody seen An Appointment with the Wise Old Dog? Ah, good. It's a beautiful, moving film. And this is a man, David Blum, who is a conductor and a composer. And he was dying of cancer. And he had Jungian analysis, 6 years of Jungian analysis with an analyst in Zurich. So he had been working with his dreams for years. And so he started to work with his dreams and draw, paint. And it helped him through his crisis of work. And so I'm going to show you a piece of it where he's working with a particular aspect. See if I can do this again. Thank you.
by a power quite the... It's an amazing fact that at the time of dire crisis, people often unexpectedly find themselves supported by a power quite beyond their ordinary experience that makes it possible for them to cope. Any powerful image that arises spontaneously from within, no matter how irrational it may seem, carries a creative potential. I had such an experience 9 years ago when my cancer was first diagnosed. According to the scans, the risks were extremely high. The night before my operation, I had a dream in which a soulful woman came to my bedside. She gave me 2 dappled eggs she had taken from a golden eagle. From each of the eggs, a golden child was hatched. One was named Waves, and the other Wings. Energy flowed forth from these children, consisting of all that is most beautiful in human feeling. When I awoke, I spoke to Sarah rapturously of the Waves and Wings, and of the wonderment of our love. I still remember babbling joyfully as I was wheeled to the operating room. If the blessing of a helpful spirit could be conveyed spontaneously to someone in deep dread, it was conveyed by the magical woman on that night. I should explain that I'm a pragmatic, down-to-earth person, not a seer or a mystic. I'm a modern skeptic without religious preconceptions. All of this doesn't matter when I'm gripped with an image from a dream of astonishing power so that it plants its authenticity upon me. This process intensified greatly during the last 3 years since the recurrence of cancer. This soulful woman, whom I call Mary, is not new to me. She first came to me in a dream when I was 17. I was then in Paris for the first time, living by myself and quite alone. In the dream, a young woman led me through wheat fields that swayed in the wind to the music of Beethoven's Pastoral Symphony. There was a certainty about her, an inevitability in her stride. I felt that it was my fate to be guided by her. The picture, the first of my paintings, made 10 years after the dream, suggests in a primitive way something of her knowingness, her resolve. But the marvel of her presence vastly exceeded my artistic ability. I had no idea then what Mary's goals were or the power of consolation she would eventually bring me. Over time, I've come to realize that this feminine presence is not merely a personal experience. She's found in legends, in literature. For Dante, she was Beatrice, leading him from purgatory to paradise. Goethe spoke of the eternal feminine, Jung of the anima, the feminine form of soul. She's come to me in dreams, in many different transformations. Passed since I first fated Mary, years of growing fulfillment. Mary's wheat field was now ripe. It was time for me to be a full participant in the harvest. Sometimes when I make a picture, I find myself being led further into the dream, as if it wanted to be continued. As I was working on this picture, it seemed that Mary drew herself as a peasant woman cradling a child. I can't fully interpret these pictures. The dreams are larger than I am. They explain me more than I can explain them. Nor can I explain their special ability to clue me into values the conscious mind has neglected. We all know of fairy tales in which an animal mysteriously appears to help the protagonist out of danger at the critical moment. Let me introduce you to such an animal. His name is Alfonso. I acquired him when I was 6. He led a peaceful life on the shelf for half a century. But after my recurrence of cancer, he started to come into my dreams, guiding me with the assurance of a wise old man, speaking with a distinctive voice of his own, with an archaic turn of phrase. Some of my doctors recommended a second major surgery. Others counseled caution and further testing. I felt trapped in a medical labyrinth. One night, I dreamed that I was alone in the midst of a mountain valley. To my amazement, Alfonso's voice was heard. "Trust," he said, "and thou shalt not be alone." I knelt in prayer. From far off, a motorcyclist of death came roaring toward me. Alfonso appeared, raised a golden spear, and said, "God will act." Instantly, the motorcyclist was destroyed. The hand of God descended from the clouds. God will act. What a grand concept. But could I believe in it? After all, I hadn't any idea of who or what God may be, or whether God exists at all. And on whose authority was I accepting this pronouncement? That of a toy dachshund. The vision started me, and it seemed inherently right to support my childhood animal when he came on my behalf to battle the forces of chaos. I've since learned that the wonder of Alfonso's statement is that it can...
Okay. We're going to another place. This is a beautiful movie. It's catching up with itself.
The cancer was found at last. And in a place that was inoperable, we decided to hit it with my lifetime limit of additional radiation. One morning, I found myself alone in my hospital room, undisturbed. I thought this would be the time to accept Papagena's challenge to step into the magic mirror. The question was, how can a hospital room turn into a wheat field? I thought I might try to conduct married music to myself. Mary immediately appeared. We wandered arm in arm through the fields. Sarah was there too. Amazing ease, Mary lifted me above the valley. At first, I held on to Sarah's hand, but as I was taken higher into the sky, I was forced, against my dearest wish, to let go of it. This was unbearably painful, so painful that I couldn't even draw it. As Mary and I glided among the clouds, I felt burdenless, without anguish. But it wasn't time yet for me to leave the earth. She took me back down to the fields. Mary then told me that just as the medical radiation would infiltrate my body, her radiation would infiltrate my mind. She let the intense rays of her light pass into me. I was bathed in her luminosity, shaken to the core of my being. Medical radiation.
Okay, so that's powerful.
What is that?
An appointment with the wise old dog. You can only get it through the website. Go to David Blum, B-L-O-O-M. So, what? That was powerful. It wasn't an image of somebody doing it. This was somebody really doing it. It's a half-an-hour movie. It's just, I'm sobbing by the time I get to the end of it. He does die about, I think, about 6 or 8 months after this. So this was a man who was used to working with the unconscious, used to working with his dreams, and so he allowed himself to get out of the way, and the pictures emerged. And we didn't see this, but his whole bedroom is just, all of his paintings are all around his bedroom. It has become his sacred space. So what level of the unconscious is he working with here? Is he working with the personal unconscious, his shadow, his stuff from childhood?
Both.
What?
Both. The dog.
The dog was from
his
childhood.
Consciousness.
Yes. Isn't that beautiful that he has this dog? And then also the woman came to him in a dream when he was 17.
And how her the music that he associated with that dream of experiencing her became almost like a shaman's power song for him going
right.
into the state that was healing.
Right. That was the threshold that he found to enter in, right? Mm-hmm. And his wife was very devoted to him. And Yo-Yo Ma was a friend of his also, so he had a community around him. But this wasn't a journey where he was, it was a very much a soulful, kind of a lone journey, wasn't it? You know, nobody could follow him here. And what did it give him? What transformation did it give him?
Peace.
What else?
Curiosity.
Well, then he told his story for other people. So
mm-hmm. Yeah, he brought this gift to us, yeah. Didn't he? Mm-hmm.
Faith in the process.
Faith in the process. Total faith in the process. In fact, at one point he says, after they gave him radiation and it wasn't working, he said that we're just going to stop that. We're just going to trust the inner images are taking me somewhere. They're doing something else besides medical stuff. And I need to trust them and follow them. The medical stuff doesn't matter anymore.
So he was having healing.
Yes. What kind of healing?
Well, spiritual healing.
Spiritual healing. Right. His body wasn't being healed, but his spirit was being healed. Sometimes the body isn't healed, but how do we... I work with people with chronic fatigue and other kinds of illnesses. And there's, of course, a lot of anger and grief and bitterness about losing their lives, their outer lives. And so and of course, we have to honor all that, all those feelings. But one of the things I keep saying is when we don't have an outer life, how do we make meaning? Where do we find meaning? Where do we find our life? Yeah. I have a client who had horrible PTSD, and she's just blossoming. And she had, when she was abused, she would go up in her bedroom, and she had a toy tiger. And she would cry, and she would rub its ear. And the ear has no fur on it anymore. And she would also surround herself in her bed with a circle of her stuffed animals. And that became her sacred space. And at one point when she had sort of forgotten about the tiger and lost it, and then it came up in the analysis. And just at a critical time in the analysis when we were working together, her parents were going through the attic and they found the tiger. And they asked her if she wanted it. And she still has it to this day. And when she's going through a really hard time, she sits with her tiger and she holds that ear. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. Yeah.
Something like having childhood healing, because you just did that story, and the husband speaks to him and gives him wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, in The Beautiful Mind, what he finds, how he realizes it's a hallucination, he says, because the little girl never grows up.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
she's
right.
She's the key
yes.
to starting to...
He begins to go,
yeah.
Wait a minute.
So it's like there's a childhood integration piece in all three of those
stories. Yeah. Good memory. Yeah. So any other thoughts or questions or feelings about... these are three very powerful scenes here. To sort of ponder. So again, so we're looking for a conscious dialogue. And Jung says, you have to enter into the dialogue as you truly are. In the Red Book, he came upon many shadow figures. He came upon archetypal figures or the devil, things like that. But he at times he actually gets angry and says, why do I have to do this? Mm-hmm. So he's remains true to his feeling and his particular experience as he goes along in it. And he says, that's what grounds us. And all the 4 years that he was diving very deeply into the unconscious, which is what the Red Book is about, he continued to see patience, which grounded him, and he continued to be with his family, not much. I mean, I don't know when this man slept. He wrote 30 volumes. So any other thoughts or questions or feelings about... Yeah.
On the last piece of David's work, and he was re-diagnosed or, you know, had a reoccurrence, what was the period of time that he was doing all of the work?
In the movie?
Yes, or just his history. Mm-hmm. Do you know?
I'm not sure. Well, at the beginning he says the time period. He was not in analysis anymore. He had come back to the U.S. It was later. I'm sorry, I'd have to go look.
He had
worked with his dreams for years and years and years and years and years. So that was something a little separate from this. I mean, as he said, this figure came to him when he was in a dream when he was 17. Remember, Jung said his soul came to him in dreams before, but he didn't know it was his soul. So it's not like these things just sort of appear out of nowhere. It's like they're already in our psyches, waiting to be asked to come out, waiting to be heard.
Or seen.
Or seen. Or seen, or felt. Or moved.
There's at least two flavors of inner experience that are being discussed here.
Mm-hmm.
That there is the, you know, these dreams with a capital D that are like meaningful and powerful.
Big dreams, maybe. Yes. Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, your day to day life kind of, oh, I have an image pop into my head, or.
Right.
You know,
and so the ones you were just, the ones that pop in, that are in our lives, the projections, the stuff we haven't integrated, that's from the personal unconscious. That was set up in our childhood. The big dreams are from the collective unconscious.
Got it.
Or the transcendent realm.
How do you facilitate so you get more of the big
dreams? You don't.
Okay, so you have to leave.
You don't want to facilitate that. You want the unconscious to guide you. When I'm working with somebody in analysis, I feel like they're guiding me. And it really, really, it's wonderful because I don't have the responsibility of their process. I'm just there as a witness and a facilitator to help them learn how to listen to their unconscious and trust that and follow wherever it needs them to go.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. And the other way, and we have to end in a minute here, the other way that this comes up is an analyst called Davidson spoke about enactments in therapy or analysis. Somebody will come in and they will... I've had experiences where the negative mother has been present in the room and I can feel the energy of this judgmental negative mother. I had an experience years ago in the beginning of my training, a wonderful poet who was working with me. She walks in, and she had a real witch of a mother. And I intuitively said, the witch is going to be here today. So I said, Erica, shut up. So I was very careful through the whole process of that day to not get pulled into the witch, to not get judgmental. I could feel the judgment, and anything I was going to say would be wrong. You know that one, right? And so we got to the end of the session. I sort of sighed inside myself in relief and said, I made it. And I let my guard down. And I walked to the door with her And she looks at me and she says, I'm not paying for this session. And I just went. And I was opening the door and I just went, oh, yes, you are. She walked through the door and I slammed it. And I was shaking. I went, darn. The witch came into the room. She got enacted. And I sat down at my desk and I was just shaking and I called and I left a message and I profusely apologized and said that was totally inappropriate. I never expected to see her again. She came in the next week. She sits down and she looks at me and she says, you aren't the witch, are you? And the analysis went to a whole nother level. And what I realized in that moment was through my mistake, it's like the witch had to get enacted in some way. That was a little extreme. I would never do that now. But to
we're human.
What? To be able to let whoever needs to come into the room and speak, the anger, the pain, the transcendence, whatever needs to be in the room needs to be contained, or needs to be contained in terms of held and just accepted. One more question. Yes.
So sorry. So this is really interesting. So the witch of her mother coming through her not being aware of it,
right.
But she projected onto you mm-hmm. that you were the witch, so
she could then see it in a way.
Oh,
so by enacting it.
That's like the grace of it, is that she projects it, and then when she unwittingly goes at you, but you respond.
The witch has incredible instinct, right?
Mm-hmm. So then when you apologize, she saw it, has she already seen that you were just mirroring
it back?
No,
I think it was when I apologized, when I called up and apologized, that she was like, oh. Mm-hmm. That I was conscious. I took it in. I understood. I was conscious. I could reflect it.
I see. Wow, that's incredibly...
Yeah. Convoluted. Yeah. Okay, let me end with my favorite quote from Nietzsche. One must still have chaos in oneself to be able to give birth to a dancing star. I say unto you, you still have chaos in yourself. Okay, thank you for coming.
Thank you.